HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 172, recorded live Thursday, July 16th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks technology with Dan Bricklin.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm sitting down with Dan Bricklin. He's just written a new book called Bricklin on Technology, and you probably know him as the creator of VisiCalc, and he's a software pioneer and an old guy with a beard, and I'm just thrilled as a punch to talk to you today, Dan. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, I'm really glad to be here, Scott.
You're actually a podcaster yourself, I understand, and I didn't realize until I started poking around on your site. You've got a lot of content up there.
Yeah, I've been dabbling in it in various ways. Since I was blogger for like 10 years or more, I realized that sometimes writing things up was just so much work, and doing it with podcasting was a lot easier. It gives you everything. So I start doing that for some events that I go to, and then I got roped in because I had all this equipment.
Yeah, and it's just like being on NPR. We've got you recording on your side, and the audio is going to sound great. But I noticed that you still do a lot of writing, and you recently just wrote an article that I've actually read twice, and I'm still trying to get my head around. That's really quite long. It looks like it's about, I mean, it scrolls forever. It's probably 10 pages of text here. And you're talking about new modes of interaction. You're basically bringing together all of the different kind of big things that are happening right now, from Google Wave to Microsoft Natal. Can you talk a little bit about that chronology of adoption?
Yeah. What I realized is that there are a lot of things that were happening that look like they might be very popular in some area, and that can cause a change in other areas. If a lot of people are using a mouse, suddenly everybody has to change their applications to use a mouse. That happened way back when. Things that used to not be on PCs that moved to PCs, once the first things moved that became very popular, others did. And I realized that we're at a point now where we may have to do the same thing of change how we build things from a user interface viewpoint, from an interaction viewpoint, where GUI as we knew it, is, and the modes of interaction with applications like we used to have with plain old Excel and Adobe Illustrator and stuff like that, as if you view them as the prototypical GUI applications, the graphical user interface, mm-hmm. That we actually are moving where we may have to switch to a new one that from a programming viewpoint requires changes. Just like when we moved from character to GUI, we had to make changes in how we did our programming.
Now, moving from characters from the 80 by 20 screens or 40 by 20 to GUI seems very clear in my mind because I was around when that happened, and it's a very obvious change. But, you know, we've been pushing Windows around for a very long time. Mice are pretty much, we're definitely in the fat part of the bell curve when it comes to mice and keyboard. I'm having trouble, maybe because I'm not a futurist, getting my head around what could possibly be next other than maybe waving my hands around.
Okay, well, I'm not a futurist in terms of, I'm much more into, I love to implement, so I look at it from that
sure.
viewpoint. And what does it going to mean to us as people who are implementing? And I just remember when we went from character, well, when you went to character-based, interactive from like punch cards and stuff like that, from batch to interactive, you had to program differently and you structured things differently. And because you had to respond instantly to what was being typed, you had to be able to deal back and forth. You don't just get all your inputs together, do a lot of processing and produce output. But you're actually watching some input device. In the case of moving to GUI, you're working much more event driven. It's not just one input stream, but there are multiple input streams, different events at different times. And because it was very, what you see is what you get. Having undo became very important. That was the classic way of doing things so that you could make mistakes and stuff. Cause you often did. You, you, you weren't doing commands that you knew exactly what would happen. You're dragging and dropping and stuff, and you could make mistakes. So undo came in, and you had to structure your programs differently because of undo. And frameworks came in to help us deal with all the work you had to do to create windows and to keep track of the housekeeping. I've done a lot of work in the gestural based, the pen computing world from way back when, back in the, it's an old industry, but, there was a good sized blip in the early 90s, when Go was making the pen point operating system and, the early pen windows or windows for pen computing, came in. And, I've done programming there and realized that a lot of the stuff there, it's not like the mouse where you can just click on something and follow a hierarchy of windows to figure out what was meant and where it is, but that there's a lot of ambiguity, in figuring out what gesture was actually made, et cetera. And, when I saw Microsoft Natal, what they were, demonstrating as potential changes in how user interface would be done to the game machines. Mm-hmm. And when I saw what happened with, what Google is showing with Google Wave and looked and saw that these are not isolated things. The technologies that they're based on are technology, things that are used elsewhere and will come about of having multiple users doing input. Much richer gestures, either touching the screen or not even touching the screen, but making motions in front of the screen that where the computer watches you, and multiple interactions affecting the program, like with Wave and other, you know, Adobe Buzzword and Microsoft, I think, says they're going to have it in the new Office, online Office that they're going to be coming out with, where there's simultaneous editing or two people might edit even offline. This is what we had in Lotus Notes years ago. And then you have to reconcile with that there is, instead of having one computer, one file, one user, we now have, in essence, one file, multiple users on multiple computers. And that's a different programming paradigm and how we have to deal with that. And recording everything that goes on so that I can play it back, this Google Wave has. Letting, you know, this, keeping that whole list so you can reconcile and you can know, like what wikis do, where you can say who did this when, you have a whole history of what happened. Those things are all coming in and they will change the way we have to build some of our applications. And to me, it may be just as big a jump as it was when we went from character-based to GUI-based.
Are we just rewriting things or porting things that have been done before? I mean, is there anything actually unique or new? I mean, you've got a historical perspective here. You know, with each of these technologies, you've said, well, yeah, you know, we were doing that before, but, you know, maybe it wasn't time, it wasn't ready. It seems like, let me give you one example. I watched the iPhone announcements for the 3.0 operating system on stage. And they had some health people up for, I think it was Johnson & Johnson, and they plugged in a glucose meter into the iPhone. Right. And they kind of said, look, I can check my blood sugar and this is amazing. Isn't that innovative? And of course, you know, sitting back at my home in Oregon with sour grapes watching this saying, man, I was doing that in 1995 and it was that the world wasn't ready for my brilliance. Is all of this just a matter of porting things over, like you're talking about simultaneous editing? Here we are porting it into HTTP, moving it into a world that is now suddenly ready for that kind of brilliance.
Well, many of the ideas of what you might want to do have been there. I mean, we would have wanted to do them 100 years ago. And, you know, and we keep trying it with computers. You know, they would try those things with whatever we have today. But, you know, I mean, some of the things are like, well, let us take advantage of simultaneous editing on a word processor screen, which goes back to word processing, which goes back to, you know, whatever. And we won't even get into the history of word processing that I've been involved with for, I don't know, many, many years. Before I did spreadsheets, I was involved in word processing. you know, but that's just saying, well, the things we used to do, we should do in the new we have to apply the new paradigms to them. But it often opens up things that we couldn't do before. In that, let's say with the glucose meter, we're talking about being able to have the device that you use for so many other things that is radio connected, that's in your pocket and that you use, you know, that has enormous amount of storage. Now you can connect a glucose monitor to it. That's just a demo of what you could do, but you realize that in the future, there may be something even better of how it's maybe communicating with something that you've ingested. Which is interesting. One of the guys involved with the Natal hardware, comes from originally was a company that actually makes, a camera that you can swallow and is used for endoscopy, that transmits as it goes down to a belt that you wear. So that's not so far-fetched that we could see these things. But it's the mashing up of things that we didn't mash up before. Uh-huh. And the big thing is it's the volume. You know, waving at the computer and saying, put that there, was demonstrated back, I don't know, around 1980 at the, what is now called the Media Lab at MIT. And there are videos you can watch of it. And, that was on a huge screen that, you know, they had to put this big ground glass in the building, which cost them thousands and thousands of dollars. And now we're talking about that in a video game console that you buy, you know, at Best Buy and that are used, you know, for the most mundane of things. That's a big change that we went from something that only the richest research lab could do a simple demo of that, versus something that is robust enough to be used, you know, by people who are busy partying and not paying much attention and expect extremely good response from it at price points that are throwaway price points.
Is that maybe you've really kind of nailed it right there. Is that the distance between when someone conceives of something, you know, starts formally researching it and then sells it at Walmart? Is that time a fixed time? Does it need to be a decade, 2 decades?
No, it's not a fixed time, but you often can find it being like 20 years. I mean, sometimes it's 10 or 20 years until the first commercial one. I mean, think about the mouse when the mouse was first invented, and other pointing devices maybe a little bit before that, it first was in a normal office device. I mean, you had, you know, the Xerox Star, and then, you know, you had, the Lisa, and then almost consumer level, at least, marketed as such with the Macintosh, but then into being accepted generally in business and in the home as the dominant way was yet another, I don't know, 8 years or something like that. So, some of the things that we're seeing much faster, you know, in terms of like, certain things with cell phone and things like that adoption, right. You know, the adoption of digital cameras. I don't know. It depends. You can always go back and find something that goes way back, you know, that's more primitive that somebody tried. But as I point out in the essay, I realized that there were these, you know, when you hear from a marketing viewpoint and business viewpoint, they talk about early adopters and, you know, and then the early majority and, you know, the late majority and stuff. But that's a purchase. I was looking in terms of when does it become the way that everything is done is the platform accepted.
Right.
Even if it was well accepted in a narrow area, when does it become accepted for even glucose meters now connect to your cell phone as opposed to being a standalone device?
Well, and then you start getting into things like standardization. So, you know, for example, as a diabetic, 15 years ago, it would cost me $100 for a glucose meter. I'd have to, you know, get a prescription or go hunting for one, and it would take a minute from the time I gave it my blood until it gave me a number. Now I can go to Walmart and I can buy one for $5. They've changed the model. It's like Gillette, where they sell the blades and give away the razor. I can get a glucose meter for virtually nothing, and it takes 5 seconds to check my numbers. And that took, you know, 10, 15 years. How long until we have standardization, though? Because right now, every glucose meter is different. Every test strip is different. You'd like to be able to show up and say, oh, here's the glucose meter for my Nokia phone. But ultimately, it would be better than that, right? Because they're just now talking about standardizing cell phone power adapters.
I mean, when is it going to be that everybody basically gets, basically blood tests that they do periodically or can do as frequently as they want for check and other health things that are just, as a matter of course, their tricorder. Basically, everybody has their mini tricorder as part of what they do. Just like all sorts of things now are so cheap and so widespread that, you know, we put them in the middle of other things. Who would believe that GPS would be something you would throw into a cell phone as a sort of a side effect thing?
That's interesting. It'd be just simply because it became so small. It was like, well, there's one more device that we're carrying around that has batteries and buttons and a screen. You know, I remember there was a time in the mid-90s where I think I had 6 or 7 devices that I was charging simultaneously. I was just wishing that whatever the core, the essence of that device would become standardized.
Yep.
It would seem the core rather would sit inside of a host. I always expected that a company would start up a screen input battery, you know, shell, and then we would plug in these modules. I thought it might be the handspring visor, which was right. The first Palm Pilot that had that slot in the back.
Right.
I never would have guessed that it would have been a phone that would become that thing, whether it be, you know, any smartphone, BlackBerry, iPhone, or Windows Mobile. Whoever standardizes that faster is gonna win.
Yeah, I mean, it's wind is the thing that the minor use that you need it for anyway. Like cell phones needed it to do positioning for 911, okay, for emergency positioning. That once you need it for that, it's also available for so many other things, and the cost then the incremental cost is nil or nothing. And of course, this becomes very disruptive to other devices or businesses that are based upon the scarcity of that type of thing, and that you want a specialized one. This has happened, of course, with voice, where voice over IP basically costs nothing compared to other things you want to do over the internet. So that something that used to be extremely dear and costly, and you could charge for, now, as a matter of fact, comes for free when you do other things that you're willing to pay for. And the thing about the cell phone is, I point out, you know, in the book, in that early chapter on what will people pay for, communicating with loved ones is a social aspect, is a very compelling thing. And often will drive why you will buy a device and pay for things. And once you have that, then other things come for free. That the reason that we carry a cell phone, I believe, is very social. You sort of hold on to the cell phone. Many people, you know, it's a comforting thing because it's a wormhole that on the other side is all of your, you know, space-time warped all of your friends and relatives, people that matter to you, especially the cell phone that's your personal one. Let's ignore the business, assuming you can turn off business stuff. But, and you see people clutching it with and bringing it as a feeling of security, holding it like they would a railing when going up and down steps.
Is it the emotional connection? I mean, in your essay on what people will pay for, you say that, you know, people will pay for that interaction with people they care about. But I'm starting to wonder if how much of technology is driven by that emotional connection versus by fear. I mean, don't we carry cell phones out of fear? I mean, I remember I have told my wife a number of times when she's left without her cell phone, I've had kind of irrational discussions where it's like, you didn't have your cell phone, I couldn't get a hold of you.
Right.
Well, just 100 years ago, we would say, all right, I'm going to go over that hill there. If I'm not back by August, you know, you can worry.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, originally a lot of people would get them because, oh, well, my car might break down in a deserted area and I need to be able to, you know, in a snowstorm, I want to be able to call. But they found out that the reason they liked it and the reason they'll pay for more minutes is completely, I mean, otherwise you just need, what you're talking about, you just need, an emergency call. but people pay for unlimited minutes and, you know, and love the unlimited nights and weekends and stuff like that and the text messaging and stuff, a lot of which is, as I point out, is very much like primates sitting there next to each other pulling nits off of each other. You know, mm-hmm. it's a social thing, and social things are very important. The social aspect of things are very important. We think of them as important to us, but we often ignore the fact that it's important to others and don't take that into account. And that's one of the things I point out. I mean, I try to show a lot of things throughout the book about how it isn't always what you might think it is, unless if you look carefully and about what's really going on. It's worth looking to see what's really going on. And a lot of the early decisions, like, well, this blogging stuff, I mean, it's just people in pajamas who don't know what they're talking about. And how can they make money? Where the real question mm-hmm. was, how are newspapers going to stay in business? If you look back on what bloggers wrote back, for example, at the Democratic National Convention in 2004, some of what they wrote was pretty good in hindsight. I mean, pretty amazing stuff. And only, I mean, I was putting this stuff together to show some history, some examples of what happened throughout blogging, the history of blogging. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at what was written back then. And in perspective, they were pretty good, even though people were making fun of them. And people are making fun of them about how, oh, blogging will never make it compared to national media. And now, of course, the blogs and personal media are now major sources of information and drive politics in many ways.
Now, is that just the democratization of technology? The idea, like what you'd said about before, that there was a time when no one had this. I mean, you could go back even farther. We've talked before on the show about the idea that no one could read, and there was a time when no one saw pieces of paper or parchment. Only the monks had those pieces of parchment. And now I probably wouldn't step down to pick up an old Nokia phone that I found in the gutter. Is it just the leveling of the playing field?
Yeah, well, I mean, personal computers, that was the beauty of watching personal computers come in. What it did is it took something that only big companies could afford, graphic arts departments and, newsletters, suddenly the smallest nonprofit or club could have, produce newsletters that were as good looking as the best things produced by corporations before that. In terms of keeping track of information with database and transaction processing, you could run it on a personal computer with DBase and stuff like that and have just as good information as the big corporations had. And so the personal computer and computing, the dropping in price of computing technology is leveling the playing field for many things and is bringing to more people abilities that didn't exist before. It was interesting at the hearing on the Supreme Court justice yesterday, where the new senator Franken asked a question about isn't the internet something where First Amendment we have to think about it, because it is a dominant way in which we communicate and express ourselves in speech, which is a very interesting. I mean, that this is. Who could believe that and knowledgeably on both sides, the questioner and the justice being questioned, that at Supreme Court hearings, justices would ask about their TiVos or their iPods, that, that level of technology acceptance just blows the mind of us from the old days when people would make fun of these toy computers. And how it's now become something that has given great power to all sorts of people, but disrupting business models and things the same way the automobile disrupted all sorts of problems with buggy whips and horse feed and stuff.
Hey, everybody. This is Scott coming at you from another place in time. Summer is peaking, and our friends at Telerik are working at full steam. They've just released the Q2 volume of the Telerik Premium Collection for .NET, the biggest release yet. It's packed with new things that'll excite anyone who's got to do anything with .NET development, starting with Silverlight and the introduction of the first commercial 3D chart in the market. It's developed as a true vector 3D, which gives you nice performance and rich capabilities with rotation and animations. Also, the Silverlight Scheduler, which is packed with even more features than the first version. Telerik's flagship, RAD Controls for ASP.NET Ajax, grows in this release, not only with four new controls, but also with new productivity tools. There's the new Visual Style Builder, an online application that allows you to visually modify skins or even design new ones with just point and click. If that's not enough, they've added a completely new product, a free testing framework powered by Art of Test for automating Ajax and Silverlight-rich internet applications. I'm short on time, so I can't give you all the new features and enhancements in Telerik Reporting, Open Access ORM, or WinForms, but I encourage you to check out all of these products at Telerik.com. Thanks. Have we seen the, you know, the complete set of the class of electronic devices that have, you know, become that pervasive? I mean, are we, you've got, you know, before we had radios and TVs, and that was pretty much it, right? There was, that was the extent of electronics. And then there were, you know, there were certainly cars and things like that. But as far as like the electronics the average Joe interacted with in the, on a regular basis, it was pretty much a, maybe a calculator if there was an accountant around, some kind of a paper. Mm-hmm. You know, a calculator that produces paper. But now we're looking at time-shifting digital video, mm-hmm. digital video in your pocket, cell phones, personal computers. Is there some other class of device? I mean, I remember when the Sony Walkman came out and everyone said, no one's going to use that. It looks silly. Who's going to walk around with headphones on their head? It's never going to happen.
Right. And then the same thing with cell phone headphones, right? And now, you know.
Yeah. And I, you know, I don't think that one is, I'm going to have to say, I don't think that one's going to change. I cannot think of anything more irritating than why I watched a guy have dinner with his family, recently at a restaurant, and he had that stupid thing plugged into his head the whole time. He wasn't talking to anybody, but it just gave that impression that at any moment I could receive a call more important than my family. I need to take it. And the act of lifting the phone to my ear is so much effort that I'm going to just go ahead and keep it plugged in like Uhura from Star Trek because, you know, I'm just, that's how I roll.
Suppose instead that what that was doing is augmenting their conversation with you, being used as that, or as those of us who are getting older and are hearing, you know, too many rock concerts and stuff, hearing is going, if it's acceptable to have big things on your ears, and assistive devices like that, then maybe we don't have to make these tiny little, hearing aids that have to be invisible, but we can do things that maybe technically could be much more powerful by being able to use bigger ones because it's now socially acceptable to have something big on your head. I mean, and that's something I've been looking and hoping would happen. But we'll see.
The augmented reality thing is very interesting. I was at a Microsoft conference recently and a guy showed me and I think we're all into Star Trek metaphors in this talk. I'm not sure if that's bringing the talk in a good direction or bad direction, but kind of a Geordi LaForge style, sunglasses that had, I think it was an 800x600 screen I could see. Mm-hmm. They were taking advantage of the way that the eye worked such that it wasn't actually blocking your vision, but it looked like it was overlaid over your vision. Mm-hmm. And it was entirely voice-based. So you could be walking around and say something like, you know, navigate to CNN.com and it would come up. It was kind of like you just described in the background.
Right.
And then recently there was a smartphone application that said that too many people were bumping into poles while texting.
Right.
So what it ended up doing was it takes the camera on the phone and it makes the background of your email what's behind the phone.
Oh, that's very Walkman-like. You remember
exactly.
The original
Walkman?
Exactly.
So then you're walking forward with your head down, but you're actually looking forward by virtue of the fact that the camera, you know, works that way. I thought that was a very strange way to kind of augment reality.
Yeah, well, I mean, the original Walkman had a microphone on it so that two earphone plugs, mm-hmm. so that you could be walking with a friend, but you could hear the sounds of walking, you know, of cars going by if you wanted to. They eventually dropped that, I guess.
That's a great idea.
So it's cool to have that idea, but I'm thinking in terms of augmentation. Well, first of all, when you think of this Natal ability to gesture and stuff, so you don't even have to be seen what you're doing. In essence, you're signing to the computer in a way. Or it's not just waving as much as you could, at the same time that you're talking, you can be controlling and the other person can see you doing it and understanding it so that, and of course they may have one too. So I could say, oh, it was a really cool thing I saw. Look at this. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and we bring it up on both our screens, which is kind of an interesting thing to do.
And that still hasn't happened.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to have that stuff. I think that we have the device with the cell phone, the thing that basically the small thing that you carry in your pocket, the Palm Pilot was one of those, the cell phone, the digital camera, and we're merging a lot of those things together. Some uses of computing, such as simple, you know, the equivalent of text messaging or whatever, sending a message asynchronously, that people can look at when they want, that doesn't require them to give their whole attention and stop everything they're doing instantly, synchronously with you to communicate. But I think we're going to see more wall-sized devices, and we can we can control them much better now that we have, if we have gestural interfaces, like we're seeing with CNN. And CNN frequently uses that that magic wall with multiple people as they discuss and look at things. In other words, one person's talking to another and saying, see this, and it's augmenting the conversation. And the control of it is much more more transparent to both people watching it. And I also think it's really something that means training is better because I watch you use it. I learn things that I didn't know I could do.
That's a really good point. And I think that people definitely want that kind of interaction because I think that the listeners would probably agree that often we'll find ourselves watching a TV show or a movie with, you know, with the spouse or in a group. And someone says, hey, is that actor from that thing? And whoever has the tiniest laptop definitely, you know, pulls up the Internet Movie Database to look at that. And then the laptop is passed around.
Right.
That interaction could happen on a giant table in front of you.
Right.
Or on an overlay somewhere on the screen itself that everyone's already looking at. It's kind of ironic that we want that interaction so much that we would drag the laptop along with us.
Right. And it may be so much more socially acceptable to be doing the search while they watch you doing it rather than have you turn your head down and lose the from the conversation that we're both sort of checking at the same time. I mean, there's all this fine tuning of it. And, you know, I tried to, you know, in the book, I try to provide lots of background for a lot of this thinking, learning to think that way. I wrote the essay because I was in a certain mindset having worked on this book. In essence, this is like a last chapter that was written based on stuff that happened after the book was done. That I got used to looking at these, putting a lot of things together, looking at some trends, the sensitivity, like Professor Ariely that I talk about in a chapter about cooperation, about how about the difference between free versus not free. And there are a whole lot of social aspects of what I'll do for a group and what I'll do only when I'm paid. The aspect of – back to Star Trek – in the interview that I did, which was available first as a podcast, but it's a transcript in the book, with a person who was the commander of the USS Enterprise. Okay. Not the Starship Enterprise, but the USS Enterprise. And he was a commander of that fleet on, September 11th, 2001.
Is this an aircraft carrier?
Yeah. It's an aircraft carrier. Actually, it's a battle group that included an aircraft carrier. And, they got to watch, of course, on CNN or whatever, you know, what was happening in New York and at the Pentagon and stuff, and horrified. But then they zipped, over to, near Pakistan, I think, and shot the first cruise missiles that were sent to Afghanistan. Okay. When this captain was controlling and the people were controlling the cruise missiles, they did it using chat rooms. Okay. And with maybe hundreds of people in a variety of chat rooms controlling military, real military equipment, where the commander and the head admiral or whatever was able to lurk and watch what was going on and maybe see a comment from somebody multiple levels down and use their background to say, oh, you know, this means such and such. And it's all quiet. So it's very eerily quiet and nice and calm because a lot of it's not people yelling, squawking into microphones and radios. And this is completely different than the image you got in Star Trek, which is so 1950s command and control, you know, that the top person talks to the next level, who talks to the next level, talks to the next level.
And it's a big conference call.
In essence, it's a big conference call, but it's done. But conference calls, you have to be careful of who's speaking. When you have a lot of multiple chat rooms, all, you know, you're looking at multiple ones on the screen. I mean, this is how they really work today. If you can't do multiple chats, you can't be a Navy SEAL. That kind of weird. Not just you have to be able to see well and shoot well and, you know, certain things like that. To be, you know, really good in the military, you have to be able to deal with multiple chat conversations, which I found out. That wasn't the image we had in the old days. And it's technology driven that makes this possible, because that wasn't possible. I mean, they used to have many people would be on a telephone call, right? But how many telephone calls can you be on at once? You can only sit in on one. And what happened during 9/11? Well, some people didn't happen to be listening to the right call at the right time. You know, I mean, with certain things. And we had point-to-point communications. And if you look at another chapter, I talk about a lot what happened in during 9/11 and stuff with communications and what we learned from that. And the fact that we can have multiple conversations simultaneously is a technology thing we didn't have. Radios don't make that easy because we can only listen to one at a time.
Well, and ultimately, we can only look at a chat one at a time, but we can read faster than we can hear.
We can roll back. This gets back to you know, Google Wave and stuff. The fact that you can roll back and say, ooh, wait, what was this? What did I miss? You know, when they say, Dan, what do you think? You know, you can quick roll back and see what the conversation was to be able to, you know, which, you know, depending on how much is happening, how fast. But, you know, younger people, I'm assuming have been, this is where there is a difference in age. A lot of younger people are much more used to doing multiple, things they're paying attention to, doing homework at the same time that you're chatting with multiple people or whatever. That, mm-hmm. you know, to older people, we just can't imagine such a thing, you know, and aren't skilled at it. But that is a skill that many people do have now.
Right. You know, one of the things that is significant about all of the things we've talked about is that in a lot of instances, the language and the application architecture are not there for us to do these things.
That's right.
The appropriate level of abstraction isn't quite there yet. There's too much asynchrony for the average programmer to handle right now. Systems as they are these kind of systems would be very difficult to write.
We need frameworks, just like windowing. Just think what it was like. Oh, we have graphics. Well, you know what it's like to build an entire windowing system if you had to do it yourself, you know, mm-hmm. and to make the scroll bars work right and all those things. And you know, so you really like to have the libraries, the APIs, the frameworks for dealing with all of those things, the tools that let you do that. And in these new paradigms that we're seeing, the ways that we're expecting computing to work, because we use it in other parts of our lives so much, that's going to drive changes. And that's why I mm-hmm. raised the flag and suddenly realized, as programmers, we have to realize that we're going to have to deal with this over time in the not too distant future. And even in corporate, eventually you have to switch. It may not mm-hmm. be till 10 years from now. But you may have to start learning some of this and to know when it's appropriate.
And at the beginning of the interview, I kind of tongue-in-cheek introduced you as an old guy with a beard. I think that, you know, guys like myself that are, you know, I mean, I'm in my mid-30s, kind of have this archetype of the old Unix guy with a beard. And I'm surprised, it feels like there's fewer older folks, and I don't necessarily mean old guys, but, you know, ladies as well. There's fewer older folks than I would have expected by now. How come you're not tired of computers? Why didn't you burn out and start fishing?
Well, I love it. I mean, I actually changed my life from being, you know, a CTO who wasn't doing much to going back to programming. And I've been doing a lot of programming, mm-hmm. Most of it in JavaScript recently. Before that, some Perl and stuff. because, well, I'm frequently asked questions, and I like to, and I do consulting of various sorts, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I need to know what's happening today. And I love programming. I love it when, you know, I mean, if you're a programmer, you know the joy of the craft. And I happen to like that a lot. I mean, I when talking to Bill Gates, I've talked to him times when he, you know, wistfully, you can see a look on his face. Oh, I remember when I shipped code, you know, the last time on the TRS-80 Model 100 or something. And, mm-hmm. That was, you know, it's a thing that I love and I need to stay up to date to be able to comment upon it.
Mm-hmm. But so often I hear about people who've only been doing this 5 years, 10 years. They're like, oh, I'm burned out. It's coming too fast. How do you keep from getting burned out with the speed at which things
periodically
come?
I go back and do the other thing. You know, I'll do a startup or something. I'm involved in business and stuff like that. Or I do expert witness work. I get to look in the – go back to the past looking at old patent stuff or things.
Taking a break.
Yeah, it's been – there's lots of but I happen to – I mean, I like it. I mean, and maybe those that burn out quick weren't meant for it. I mean, there are a lot of people who made it through the that horrible time after 2000, you know, when you couldn't, there was no money for tech and stuff like that. And those that stayed in it, not for the money. They stayed in it for the love of the technology. Mm-hmm. But there are many ways of going. Maybe what you're doing, you should change. Like I'm starting to do more programming. I think I'll be doing more programming for the handhelds. For the mobile phone. I have an iPod Touch and I have an Android, you know, G1, and I just got a Palm Pre. And since I'm a JavaScript programmer, I'm very excited about the Palm Pre. Mm-hmm. And, I'm excited, you know, when I see, how Google is pushing what you can do with HTML5 and things and Microsoft acknowledging that you can do a lot with the stuff they're showing with the latest incarnations of their tools they're doing using the browser. There's cool stuff there. And there's always new things you can get into. You know, I got into pen computing a while back. I got into blogging and podcasting. Mm-hmm. I'm having the fun of working with all this cool electronic audio equipment. I tried writing a book, which was an interesting experience. In terms of that, though, being the son of and grandson of a printer, I had been in the print world in various ways way back when, typesetting and, computerized typesetting and word processing. There are always new things you can keep fresh with. You don't have to be, you know, implementing the 500th Fortran compiler, which in our days, mm-hmm. The thing I was taught to be in college, you know, is to be a developer of Fortran compilers or something like that. There's always something new you can do with computing to keep it fresh.
Yeah. It's interesting because that is the question that comes that people ask me the most is that how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep from getting bored? And how do you keep from getting overwhelmed at the same time? It's just the idea that there are those, and I was this guy too. I have this archetype that I refer to of the chief architect of the Nebraska Department of Forestry. You know, he's got some kind of an important job and he's in charge of something important, but his job betrays him. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to, you know, be an access programmer for 10 years and yeah. not eventually, just completely get burned out and say, gosh, I wish I could work on this. And then life and everything prevents one from tinkering around in the garage, but it sounds like you just have to just do it. You just jump in. You know, you jumped into podcasting. You got your equipment. You're doing videos on YouTube now. Mm-hmm. You just have to keep pounding forward. It sounds like.
Yeah. You have to figure out. I mean, video I got into because I was getting into open source and licensing and legal stuff. And I wanted to do a training video about mm-hmm. to train programmers about the, you know, some legal things. Because I figured a programmer talking to a programmer would be a good thing. And it was either pay somebody to videotape me or teach somebody to blog who set up a studio for me so that I could buy the equipment for the same amount of money I could have paid, hired a crew for and do it myself. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly I was into video and had learned to edit and stuff like that. But, you know, that's why you have to look at what changes that are occurring that even if you're at you know, a department of something or other. Maybe the technology has moved where it is in the interest, not just for fun, but in the real interest of your institution, that there be a step. The next thing you do, you can build in a way that you can take advantage of some of the new things. And on the side, you may just have to, you have to stay fresh, but you have to carefully choose what it is you're going to do. I mean, Microsoft makes it that you have to relearn how, what it means to be a Microsoft programmer every certain number of years. You know, and if you get off the track of doing that, you fall behind. I mean, the stuff I know how to do, you know, with the old MFC and stuff like that probably doesn't help me today in .NET the same way that, you know, I'd have to go back, that a new person coming in isn't necessarily going to jump maybe just as fast as I would be.
Right, right. I mean, Windows itself fundamentally hasn't changed. So if you jumped into WinForms, you know, the constructs are there, but you're right. All the patterns are different. I mean, the JavaScript that I learned isn't the JavaScript that there is today.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. And, so you're constantly being forced. That's one of the things about being a programmer that I've seen over the years is that you do have to constantly re-educate yourself. Every once in a while, you basically are going to spend 3 to 6 months of not being very productive while you start, you know, learning some new type of technology that you're going to use. And a lot of programmers who are real good that I know basically choose the jobs they are getting by whether it's going to keep them fresh or not. And willing to take ones that may not pay as well, specifically so that they can become fresh and get into the latest. But you have to choose. There's always so many of them. Choosing which one is the one to learn, which will teach you a generic skill that could be helpful in many others, that's kind of tough. That's why it helps to look back and see how things have moved over time and when does something resonate that this is one to jump to. This isn't going to be a dead end for me. You would view me as a graybeard, though. On the cover of the book, they have the picture that I used in my early blogging, so I wasn't gray yet. Though inside you'll see pictures of me with gray beard. Now my beard's quite gray. But when I was, when I first started working at, one of the times at Digital, early in my career at Digital Equipment Corporation, and I was 25, I was working for somebody who, when I was born, the year I was born, he was in college working on the Whirlwind project. And you can actually see pictures of him when Edward R. Murrow, when he interviewed Jay Forrester, showing early computers in 1951, the year I was born. And I was working for somebody who was my age at the time I was working with him when I was born. And this is a guy who I think helped invent the index register or something like that, or something that was used in macro assemblers or something like that. Something we just so take for granted. And he was involved in that in the 50s. And then I was involved in things you would take for granted in the 70s. And now, you know, it's the same type of thing that there's always people who go way back. And you want to go see, this is, what can I learn from what happened? I listened very carefully to what Jack would say, what Jack Gilmore would say about the good old days. And, you know, stories from, they were pulling all-nighters for the demo they were doing for TV. The same way we do them today. It's just really weird. Some of the same stuff just keeps coming back, and it's just part of the craft.
It does all come back.
Yeah.
Well, people can read your new book. They can go to bricklin.com, and you've got a link right there on the homepage. And you're on Twitter now as Dan B.
Mm-hmm.
So twitter.com/Dan B. And I'll put all the links for all of this stuff up on the show site so that folks can connect with you online.
Good. I appreciate it. I'm glad that you like it.
Well, yeah. Well, thanks so much for sitting down and chatting with me and giving me as much time as you did. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.